Yeah, the topic for tonight is 2,000 years of church history in less than an hour. And here it is. This is the first 1,000 years of church history. This is the other half. And it's interesting that, that history is spelled his story, H-I-S-S-T-O-R-Y. So history is really the story of Christ. And the most important event in history is the incarnation, when God became man. That split history right down the middle. In fact, even our calendar, you know, we started our calendar based upon when Christ came into this world. And so this is going to be a talk on the, basically church history, you know, the highs and lows of church history. And you'll see some of the, you know, great moments of the church and some of its most difficult moments. The church has had tremendous times of triumph and tremendous times of persecution. You'll see tremendous saints and terrible sinners. The church is both human and divine. It's divine because it's founded by Christ. It's human because it's made up of human people. And so you'll see, you know, sinners within the church, and you'll see tremendous saints. You know, the church is the mystical body of Christ. It's the continuation of Christ in time and history. And so you'll be seeing the same things that took place in the life of Christ. Namely, you'll see, you know, persecution. You'll see miracles that the church has worked. You'll see times when it looks like the church has been crushed and killed. And yet you'll see times of resurrection when the church, you know, flourished. So the church is the mystical body of Christ, the extension of Christ in time. And you'll see all the things that Christ did, the church does as well. You know, working miracles, preaching, teaching, saving souls, sanctifying souls. The two most important things as far as studying a Christ-centered view of history, number one is that we have to acknowledge that truth exists, that there is such a thing as objective truth. Truth is not relative, it's objective, and truth does exist. And number two, the incarnation happened. That's what history is based upon, those two events. Those two things, that truth exists and the incarnation happened, that God became man at a historical point. So let's start with the New Testament. We have many manuscripts of the New Testament. We even have, you know, fragments of the Gospel of John found in Egypt in the year 125. So, you know, these fragments had already gotten down to Egypt by the year 125, which means that the scriptures had been written much prior to that. We have two complete Bibles, manuscripts of the Bible from the early 300s. And we have more historical evidence for the Old Testament and New Testament than we do for, you know, Cicero and Plato and these other writings. We know that Christ was born about the year 4 BC, as far as we have been able to determine, and crucified around the year 30. Now, some people say, you'll even, you know, in your apologetics, some people will say, well, you know, I don't really believe Christ actually existed. You know, that's just based upon the scripture. You can actually point to non-Christian testimony showing that Christ was a real historical person. For example, you can go to a Roman historian named Tacitus, who wrote in the 80s and 90s, who talked about, in his historical writings, about a man named Jesus who was called the Christ, who was crucified under Pontius Pilate. Again, this is a non-Christian testimony that Christ really existed. You could go to a Jewish historian named Flavius Josephus, who wrote, you know, the book called The Jewish War. He was a Jewish historian, and he referred to Jesus as a miracle worker, someone who was greater than the man who was executed under Pontius Pilate. And Flavius Josephus was also writing in the 80s. So if people say, well, it's only the Bible that talks about Jesus, you can say, no, there isn't. There is Roman anti-Christian history, and there is Jewish history that both talk about the reality of this man named Jesus. So it shows that our you know, the reality of Christ is not based upon, you know, just the scriptures, but upon secular history as well. Of course, Christ founded the church, and he said the church would be indestructible, that he would be with the church until the end of time. And right away, the church began to be persecuted. The first one to die was Stephen in the year 37. He was taken outside the city and stoned. And so right away, the church is being persecuted. Just like Christ was, you know, driven out of the city and crucified, you know, the early Christians began to be crucified. Some events started happening around the year 39 with Cornelius, who was the first non-Jew to be converted to Christianity, and that was done by St. Peter. That was a very historical event, because up until this time, it was only Jews who had become Christians. Here was a pagan Roman who became a Christian. There's a big debate. Should this person have to become a Jewish person first and then become a Christian? Is that a necessary step? And Peter said, no. You can become a pagan right into Christianity. You don't have to become a Jew first. A major event took place in the year 50, the Council of Jerusalem, the first of all the councils of the church. And many of the commentators say that this was most likely the time that our Blessed Mother was assumed into heaven, about the year 50. Because all the apostles would have come back to Jerusalem for this council and would have been present for this assumption. And that would have made Mary about the age of 70. And then, of course, Nero was the emperor from the year 54 to the year 68, and, you know, unleashed a bitter persecution, you know, against the church. But, of course, even good came out of that. You know, when the church is persecuted, like Tertullian says, the blood of the martyrs is the seed of the faith. Whenever the church is persecuted, it grows, it spreads. But also, when Nero began to persecute the Christians, they began to flee, and they spread Christianity that way. If Nero was trying to crush the church, but when he crushed it, they spread out into other parts and evangelized into the countryside. They couldn't remain in the cities, but they continued to spread the faith. People like Thomas, St. Thomas went to India, St. James went to Spain, St. Jude apparently went to Edessa, and there's an interesting speculation that the king of Edessa was converted when St. Jude brought the Holy Shroud of Turin, now known as Turin because of northern Italy, but there's evidence that the king of Edessa was shown the face of Christ. And most people think it was the shroud folded up that was brought to King Edessa. In the year 67, Peter and Paul were executed. Peter, of course, was crucified upside down. Paul was beheaded. He couldn't be crucified because Paul was a Roman citizen. In the year 70, the Temple of Jerusalem was destroyed, which Christ had predicted. The Pope after Peter, crucified in 67, the next pope was Pope Linus, and he was a pope from 67 to 79. After him, a little bit later, came Pope Clement, who was a pope from 92 to 101, and he's especially known for the letters that he wrote. For example, the letters he wrote to the Corinthians in the year 95 show papal authority at this early age. The year 95, this is a great thing to use with our Protestant brethren who say that, well, the papacy started in the 300s after Constantine made Christianity legal. Here we have letters, written by Clement, before he was killed, to the Christians of Corinth, showing that the Pope has authority over all the early bishops. Ignatius of Antioch was another early Christian. He wrote letters around the year 115, and his letter to the Church of Smyrna clearly showed an episcopacy, bishops and a hierarchy, the Pope and the bishops. And he says, if you're obedient to the bishop, you're obedient to Christ. The church had to deal with Gnosticism, which was one of the first heresies to plague the church. Gnosticism, many different brands of it, but oftentimes Gnostics did not believe in the incarnation. They believed Gnostics that they had secret knowledge, and a lot of times some of them believed that, well, Christ was not actually, the Son of God, or that he actually wasn't, truly incarnate, was not truly a man. That's why, St. John, writing against the Gnostics, really emphasized not only the divinity of Christ, but the humanity of Christ. He said, the Word became flesh. The Word became flesh and dwelt among us. Now, John had a disciple named Polycarp, who also wrote a number of letters. And Polycarp had a disciple named Irenaeus. And St. Irenaeus wrote around the year 180. And he had to deal with the Marcionite heresy, which was a form of Gnosticism. The Marcionites claimed that material things were evil and that only the spirit was good. you'll see this heresy popping up, century after century. There's a type of, also called Manichaeanism in the 12th century. It was called Albigensianism. But here, Irenaeus, following Polycarp, who knew St. John, personally, was writing against the heresies. Moving on a little bit in history, we come to, the year 220, Pope Callistus. Interesting story about him. He had to deal with one of the first antipopes. Hippolytus was an antipope, set himself up, as a false pope, and eventually, both of them were sent to do labor in the Sardinian mines. And when Hippolytus was in the mines, he repented and came back to the Catholic faith, through the example of Pope Callistus, and Hippolytus later became a saint, the only antipope ever to be converted and to be later canonized as saint. So during the first couple hundred years of the church, the persecutions were off and on between Nero, and then there's a major persecution of the church in the year 250 under Decius. Decius would say all you Christians have to sacrifice to the gods. If you don't sacrifice to the gods, you execute you. Around the year 258, Pope Sixtus II was martyred in the catacombs saying Mass with some deacons. Of course, the Christians were underground. They would have Mass down there. The Romans came in. As the Pope was saying Mass, they killed him right on the altar. And I had the privilege of being in that same catacomb a number of years ago in Rome, and we had the opportunity to say Mass in that same place where Pope Sixtus shed his blood for the faith, for Christ. And you know the story of St. Lawrence. And St. Lawrence was burnt alive on the grill. Great sense of humor. He said, "You can turn me over, I'm done on one side," he said. The year 270, the Manichaean heresy popped up again, and the church had to continue to write against those things. The beginnings of monasticism took place around the year 285 with Anthony of the Desert. Anthony, this is different than St. Anthony of Padua, who's a Franciscan. Anthony of the Desert was one of the early hermits who lived at the last part of the 3rd century. Between the year 284 and 305, one of the fiercest persecutions took place, the persecution under Diocletian and Galerius, a bitter, bitter persecution of the Christians, of the Catholic faith. And it was not until Constantine made Christianity legal around the year 312, with the Edict of Milan, that put an end to the persecution of the Christians. It was also at this time that St. Helena went to the Holy Land and was able to discover part of the true cross and brought that back. And so because of Constantine, who delayed his own baptism, he didn't want to be baptized until he knew that he wanted to wait and get baptized at the very end of his life, that we all seem to be forgiven. And he even, Constantine was, some people want to canonize him, but he actually wasn't, he was okay, but I believe he killed his wife and some of his kids and things like that. So I doubt if he'll be canonized, really. Right. And so, but he did end the persecution, he banished crucifixion, and he made Christianity legal. But of course, in other parts of the Roman Empire, persecution still took place. For example, powerful story of the martyrs of Sebaste. The martyrs around the year 320, these martyrs, there were 40 Christian soldiers, and they were taken, stripped naked, taken out to a frozen lake, and they had to stand on the frozen lake until they died. And it was a diabolical persecution of these Christian soldiers, because in order, all they'd have to do, to come off that lake would be to offer a sacrifice to the gods and they'd be free. But 40 of these soldiers, stripped naked, holding arms, singing hymns, praying together, they died on that lake, while the Roman pagans had hot baths, hot tubs, fires at the shore trying to tempt them to come in, and one soldier did. One soldier left and he came in. And as soon as he did, one of the pagan soldiers stripped off his garment and walked out. A powerful story, and 40 of them died. Powerful story. In fact, I have a beautiful tape, which maybe I'll play it at the end of this talk, a song written about that event. Then another heresy popped up called the Donatist heresy. And the Donatist heresy was the fact that there were a lot of Christians who did sacrifice to the gods, who were traitors to their faith, but who came back and wanted forgiveness. And there was a big question of, well, if priests did this, if they came back, would their sacraments be valid if they had sinned this way? And the church says yes. The sacraments did not depend upon the holiness of the priest. Even if the priest had been a traitor and sacrificed to the gods, if he repented and came back, those sacraments were still valid. In the year 320 came the Arian heresy. The Arian heresy denied basically the divinity of Christ. It denied that Christ was equal to the Father and the Holy Spirit. It said the Father was greater than the Son, and that Christ was not equal to the Father. And that, of course, was condemned in the year 325 at the Council of Nicaea, when the Church coined the phrase homoousios, that Christ is of the same substance, the same nature as the Father. One of the great proponents of the Catholic faith and the truth was St. Athanasius in the year 330, and he was really one of the few bishops, like 300 bishops had bought into this Arianism. There were very few bishops that remained loyal to the Pope, and Pope Liberius also was able to remain faithful, even though he was tortured and even though he was persecuted for believing in the divinity of Christ. Year 361, a man named Julian the Apostate tried to destroy the Christian faith. An apostate is someone who had the faith and then rejects it and then leaves the faith. And Julian the Apostate knew of the fact that the prediction was that if you could rebuild the Temple of Jerusalem, that would put an end to Christianity. That's not supposed to be done until the end of the world. And so he tried to rebuild the temple. He got hundreds of workers, and they went to the place. They tried to rebuild the temple. Earthquakes happened, tornadoes, hurricanes, and people were killed trying to do this, and it was abandoned. Even Julian the Apostate could not rebuild the temple. Year 370, St. Ambrose became one of the greatest preachers and one of the early bishops, Bishop of Milan. In fact, he was sort of funny how he became bishop. He didn't want to be bishop, but people just grabbed him and they took him and they made him bishop. And of course, he was very instrumental in the conversion of St. Augustine. And the interesting thing happened with St. Ambrose. In the year 390, Emperor Theodosius was a Christian emperor who was responsible for the massacre of thousands of people in an arena during a riot. And Ambrose told him, in order to be forgiven, you have to do public penance. And here he was, the whole Roman Empire, came and knelt down and did penance, public penance to make up for ordering the massacre of these thousands of people. Year 400, St. John Chrysostom, one of the greatest preachers in the church. The year, again, around the same time, around the year 400, St. Augustine was converted by the preaching of St. Ambrose. The year 410 came the sack of Rome by the Goths. At this time also, the heresy called the Pelagian heresy was developing. Pelagius was an Irish monk who denied original sin, and he believed that baptism was not necessary, and that you didn't need God's grace. Your nature was sufficient to get to heaven, and that of course was condemned by the church. Another heresy popped up called the Nestorian heresy around the year 428, which claimed that Mary was not the mother of God, and a layman, Eusebius, stood up. He was a layman, stood up in the church. And when Nestorius was preaching, and he said, "What you're teaching, is false teaching." And of course, in the year 431, at the Council of Ephesus, led by Cyril of Alexandria, The council at Ephesus claimed, yes, Mary truly can be called the Mother of God because Jesus Christ is truly God. That was more of a Christological heresy than it was a Mariological heresy. When you don't call Mary the Mother of God, it's not so much a criticism of Mary, it's basically denying the divinity of Christ. So in one, that council only lasted one day. Vatican II lasted 3 years. That council lasted one day, and there were thousands of lay people outside shouting, Theotokos, Mother of God. A council of Ephesus in the year 431, and it's the same place where most likely Our Lady lived with St. John after the crucifixion, Council of Ephesus. And then came the Monophysite heresy. There's so many of these heresies, I mean, there's always popping up. The Monophysite heresy, which claimed that Christ only had a divine nature, that he was not man at all, and that was condemned in the year 451 by the Council of Chalcedon. One of the greatest popes, Leo I, oversaw that council, and Leo I, you know, his writing was called The Tome of Leo, and in that, he really emphasized the divinity of Christ and the humanity of Christ. At this time, in the middle part of the 5th century, also came the barbarian conquest. You've heard of Attila the Hun. In the year 452, Attila the Hun came to sack Rome with, you know, hordes of his cohorts, and an incredible thing happened. Attila the Hun was, you know, about to invade Rome. Pope Leo went out and met him in a little tent, and nobody knows what happened in that tent, but Attila the Hun turned around and did not attack Rome. Maybe that'll happen when Bill Clinton meets President, or meets the Pope, right? So, Pope Leo met Attila the Hun. Now, John Paul II will meet President Clinton. The 5th century was also the time when St. Patrick was in Ireland. As you know, he was born in England. He was captured by, you know, pirates, taken to Ireland. He, you know, fell in love with the Irish people. He escaped and eventually came back as a priest and the bishop. And he almost single-handedly converted Ireland to Catholicism. He was born about the year 398 and died around the year 493. He lived to be about 90 years old. He was a bishop for 60 years over in Ireland. During the 500s was also the time of St. Benedict and the establishment, like the rule of St. Benedict, and some of the monastic orders began to pop up. In the middle half of this 6th century, the 550s, came St. Columbana from Ireland, as became a missionary over to Scotland and established monasteries. The year 590, St. Columbana came from Ireland and went to France and helped establish monasteries in France. So you see how Ireland was a very important a country for the reestablishment of the Catholic faith, not only because of St. Patrick's conversion of Ireland, but it wasn't long until Ireland began sending St. Columba, St. Columbanus in Scotland and France to establish these monasteries, which were centers of learning, centers of prayer and holiness. And, for example, the way France got converted was when, you know, the King of France, Clovis, became a Catholic around the year 500, and oftentimes when the king became Catholic, the whole country would enter the faith as well. And these monasteries were also the places where the manuscripts of the church were transcribed and hand-copied. They didn't have these nice Xerox machines. Everything was hand-copied. One of the greatest popes then came, Pope Gregory the Great, from 590 to 604. And he's the one who sent missionaries to England. He sent St. Augustine of Canterbury to England to convert the Anglo-Saxons. The year 570, Muhammad was born, and he began preaching around the year 610 at the age of 40. And his preaching and him being the leader of the Islamic religion has had a devastating effect upon church history. Wait till you hear what eventually happens. But today, right now, there's 500 million Muslims in the world. 950 million Catholics, 500, about half as many Muslims. Around the year 630 came the Monothelite heresy, which claimed that Christ only had one will, whereas we know he had two wills, a human will and a divine will, but his human will was always in accord with his divine will. The Church, of course, condemned this heresy, saying that Christ only had one will. In the year 636, the Holy Land was lost, taken, captured by the Muslims. It did not take long for the aggression of the Muslims to begin to override Palestine, the Holy Land, year 636. The Muslims began to overrun all of Europe. They began to overrun Egypt and Persia. They came into Spain and had captured and had taken over the entire country of Spain, with the exception of a little tiny square 20 miles by 20 miles up in the hill country in northern Spain, and it was being held by a tremendous Christian soldier named Pelayo, and all he had was 200 men against the entire Islamic force. This is the year 717, and the Muslims heard about this little guy who just had a couple square miles of land, who would not give up. And from that little piece of land, Pelayo and his soldiers, his Christian soldiers, were eventually, it took over 770 years, but eventually the Muslims were driven out of Spain. The only country ever to get rid of the Muslim occupation in the entire world, the only country ever, every other country was, most of these were lost to, especially the Middle East and all these places, but thanks to Pelayo on that little piece of land, began the reconquest of Spain, which eventually was finished in Queen Isabel around the year 1492. The year 722, interesting thing happened. Saint Boniface went to Germany, and the Germans were pagans. They worshipped trees, and especially the big oak tree. You probably heard this story of Saint Boniface, and he went to bring the Catholic faith to these people. Where they're all worshiping this huge oak tree. So what did he do? He didn't sit down and dialogue with them. He took a big axe and he chopped down, and when the trees crashed, and split, and nothing happened, all of them became Catholic. It was a great, great storm. The Boniface didn't mess around. The year 720 came the iconoclast heresy. The iconoclast heresy said that all images were bad. Iconoclasm means smash images. Smashing of images. So iconoclasm were those who said, we can't have any images, you can't have any icons, they're all bad. And of course the Church condemned those as well and says in the year 787 at the Second Council of Nicaea, says it's the veneration of icons is a very good and holy thing. The year 732, you had the Battle of Tours, a very critical battle, with Charles Martel as the Christian leader, and they defeated the Muslims in that particular battle in France. And if that battle had been lost, most likely all of France would have become Islamic. The year 800 was an important year. That was the year Charlemagne was crowned Holy Roman Emperor, and the Holy Roman Empire lasted until 1806, so it lasted about 1,000 years. The 800s also saw the advances and the battles of the Muslims. In the year 846, the Muslims sacked Sicily and Rome and just devastated those cities. The year 880s were the missionary work of St. Cyril and Methodius. You probably heard of them. Between the 800s and 900s came the pilgrimages to the Holy Land, that the Holy Land at this time was, somewhat half Christian, half Muslim, prior to the Muslims invading it and sacking it and taking it from the Christians. The Christians were able to make pilgrimage to the Holy Land, but problems began to arise. Pilgrims were attacked and killed oftentimes, and in fact, the Church of the Holy Sepulchre was destroyed by the Muslims in the year 1000. Also at this time period in history came the conversion of Poland in the year 1000 to St. Stephen of Hungary. Stephen of Hungary converted and became the Catholic king of Poland, and of course all of Poland with it. Sweden also became Catholic at this time. Iceland became Catholic, primarily when rulers converted, the rest of the country would too. Around the year 1050 came some of the difficult times for the church because of simony, which, the selling of things, and, concubinage, having, priests having a number of mistresses, and some serious problems in the church in that way. And by the year 1054, there was a lot of, political problems between the church in the east and the church in the west. And the year 1054 was the schism between east and west. And that's when the eastern, split away from the pope, which is still like it's today, with the Greek Orthodox and Russian Orthodox. But it began in the year 1054 for a number of reasons, some theological and some political. The year 1066, you've heard about the Norman conquest of England. Heard about that. During all this time, the Christians were still fighting the Muslims in Spain and other places. And El Cid, you've heard of him. There's a movie about him. The year 1085, reconquered Toledo, an important battle there. The year 1095, Constantinople pleads, the Western Church for help because they had been devastated by the Muslims. Constantinople is modern-day Turkey or Istanbul. And so the Pope called for a crusade. This is the first crusade. It happened in the year 1095. And the crusades basically were to safeguard pilgrims on their way to the Holy Land, to recapture the land stolen by the Muslims, and also to safeguard and get back the holy places, the sepulcher and the place where Christ was born, all these things, and make them safe for pilgrimages to the Holy Land. The one who really preached this crusade was Saint Bernard of Clairvaux, was also behind this, and Bernard of Clairvaux is just a tremendous saint. He helped to reform the church and establish monasteries. Unfortunately, that first crusade did not end too well. Even though it began for a just cause, you'd get some greedy people, and unfortunately there was a terrible massacre in Jerusalem in the year 1099, which the Pope, once he heard about it, was just condemned that action of the Christians, the massacre that they did for the Muslims in Jerusalem. The second crusade took place in the year 1145, and this is when the Muslims invaded Edessa and took Edessa. So the Christians went to try to free that. At this time period also, over in other parts of the world, were year 1157, you had the situation of Thomas a Becket, who was an advisor to Henry II. Thomas a Becket was martyred in the cathedral. You've probably seen the movie Becket, or some of the other movies written about, made about these people like Thomas More and Thomas a Becket. Thomas More and John Fisher were about 400 years later, but Thomas a Becket also stood up against Henry II for the rights of the church. He was martyred in the cathedral in 1170. 1174 came, again, other battles against the Muslims. This one was an interesting battle led by Baldwin the Leper King, who was a tremendous Christian king and who contracted leprosy, but he was able to win a number of battles against the Muslims. The Third Crusade occurred in 1189, and this was led by Frederick Barbarossa, who was not necessarily a great friend of the church, and that crusade basically accomplished nothing. The Fourth Crusade took place in 1201, and this was inaugurated by Pope Innocent III. He's the one who St. Francis went to and asked permission to establish the Franciscans. So Innocent III said, yes, we must regain Jerusalem you know, from the hands of the Muslims. And this crusade, the Christian force also ended up in a very bad way, because instead of going to Jerusalem, they sacked a Christian city named Zara, and the Pope condemned their actions. But there was a tremendous Christian leader named Simon de Montfort, who was from that western part of France where St. Louis de Montfort would later come from. And Simon de Montfort, when they went to sack the Christian city, he left and took his men that would not sack it. And he and the men went to Jerusalem to help free Jerusalem. After these Christians sacked the Christian city of Zara, then they went in the year 1204 and sacked Constantinople, another Christian town, you know, for plunder and for loot. This also was denounced by the Pope. So even though you can justify the Crusades as far as their initial reasons of why you'd go to free the Holy Land and make safer pilgrimages, you know, many of them, you know, just did not end in a justifiable way at all. And that's why they were condemned by certain popes and bishops, you know, because of the greed of certain people. At this time also in church history was St. Dominic and St. Francis. In the early part of the 1200s, St. Dominic was from Spain, and he began to, he established the order, later became known as the Dominicans, and their primary job was to help convert the Albigensians. The Albigensians, again, were those who believed that material things were bad, the spirit was good, and apparently, during the first 3 years of his preaching, he had very few converts. After Our Lady came and gave him the rosary, he had 100,000 converts in 3 years from the Albigensians by preaching, "Blessed is the fruit of thy womb." Blessed is it, you know, showing the sanctity of the womb. St. Francis, at the same time, around the year 1200, established the Franciscan order. St. Clare, around the year 1212, founded the Four Clares. The year 1208 came the Fifth Crusade. This was the Albigensian Crusade to southern France, to try to banish these Albigensians who were very militaristic and fighting and things like that. Simon de Montfort was asked to lead this, and he won that thanks to the the help of so many good Christians, and that basically ended the Albigensian heresy around the year 1229, and this is where the first Inquisition was set up, was in France around the year 1230 to deal with a lot of these Albigensians, these false Christians. Out of 900 people interviewed by the Inquisition, one-third of them were imprisoned, one-third of them were just given penance and released, and 42 were executed out of 900. So sometimes you get people talking about church history, they think, oh, the Inquisition was just so bloody and everybody who came before him was executed, 42 out of 900. And this was the Inquisition headed by the Dominicans. This 13th century brought about the tremendous growth of the Franciscans. In 10 years, the Franciscans grew to 5,000 followers of St. Francis. In 10 years, in 100 years, they had 30,000 Franciscans. And this is one of the most important things ever to occur in the church, was the establishment of the Franciscans and also the establishment of Dominicans. By the year 1250, there were 7,000 Dominicans. And by 100 years later, there were 10,000 Dominicans. And again, they were preaching, they were feeding the poor. Tremendous thing in church history. In 1240, saw the Mongol invasion of Europe by Genghis Khan and the people, the Mongolians. They conquered Russia, they invaded Poland, this is the 1220s, the 1230s, they invaded Germany, they invaded Egypt, they invaded Iraq. These Mongols were a combination of Muslims and Nestorians. The year 1229 came one of the greatest kings of France, King St. Louis IX of France. And he himself personally led a crusade to Egypt in the year 1249. But he was captured and then released for sizable donation and got back home. The 13th century is really considered one of the greatest centuries for the church from the standpoint of the tremendous cathedrals that were built, the Gothic cathedrals. The Gothic got its name later on from when they started building Baroque cathedrals and all these things. You know, they considered those old cathedrals sort of, you know, barbarian, so they called them, you know, Gothic after the Goths. But of course, Gothic cathedrals are just incredibly beautiful. Often took 100 years to build. Notre Dame in France was started in 1163, was not completed until 100 years later, 1260. Cathedral of Chartres started being built in 1194, was finished in 1260. Cathedral of Reims in 1214, finished in the year 1300. So 85 years to build, 100 years to build some of these things. And these were built by the Christians themselves, and not by some contractors, some workers that you hire and they come in and build a church. These were built by the Christian people, by guilds, by artists and craftsmen, stonemasons and all these things. And tremendous thing. The Psalms of the century also saw incredible flourishing of intellectual life. The University of Paris, the year 1215, St. Thomas Aquinas at the University of Paris, being taught by Albert the Great. St. Thomas Aquinas, the greatest minds ever in the history of the church, wrote the Summa and all these tremendous writings. In the 13th century, same century as St. Francis, St. Dominic, the cathedrals, Thomas Aquinas. The year 1274 came the Second Council of Lyon. That's what Father Mayer talked about. This is one of the councils that preached about heaven, hell, and purgatory. This was also trying to heal the 1054 schism when the Eastern Church had broken away. And they also dealt with this question of the filioque. The filioque is a Latin word for meaning "and the Son," because in the Western Church, we believe that the Holy Spirit proceeds from the Father and the Son, whereas the East say the Holy Spirit only proceeds from the Father. But we believe, and it's in our creed, the Holy Spirit proceeds from the Father and the Son. That was one of the theological differences between the West and the East. Then, in the year 1347, a terrible thing, one of the worst things in the history of the world, occurred, called the Black Plague. You've heard of it, called Black Death. Bubonic plague carried by rats. Swept Asia, swept Europe. 25 million people died outside of Europe, and probably 60 million people died in Europe from the Black Plague. Two-thirds of Europe was killed. 66% of Europe was killed by the Black Plague. Half the population of Paris died in 4 years. 800 people a day died in Paris. Then came the was called the Avignon Papacy at the same time, from the 1316 to 1378. And this was when the popes left Rome during this period of about 60 years, and they lived in France, in Avignon. And it was because of Bridget of Sweden and her letters, and the letters of St. Catherine of Siena in 1373, that brought the papacy back to Rome. Then came the 1380s, when a very difficult decade for the church, because there was one real pope and two anti-popes walking around, all three claiming to be pope, and a lot of confusion at that time. This is the end of the 14th century. Then came some of the heresies established by John Wycliffe, pronounced in many of those two ways, depending on which part of the country you come from, I guess. 1324 to 1384, he denied the real presence of Christ in the Eucharist. He denounced the papacy. Another heresiarch, good word, isn't it, heresiarch, in the 1400s, named John Huss from Bohemia, also denied the real presence. The year 1414 came the Council of Constance, and this was to elect the new pope and to try to show which were the anti-popes and which ones were the real popes. Then came the Hundred Years' War. This was between the year 1330 and 1450, the fighting between England and France. And the reason why this was important was because this is where Saint Joan of Arc came on the scene. And she was able to bring about the France victory over England. And again, both of these were Catholic countries, fighting one country, fighting another country. And the thing is, if France had lost, England would have taken over France, and when England left the church 100 years later, because of Henry VIII, France would have left the church as well. So it was because of Joan of Arc and her military victory that eventually would keep France Catholic. Joan of Arc was eventually burned at the stake in 1431, and yet 20 years after that, a court convened and condemned that trial that Joan of Arc was tried in, and eventually Joan of Arc was canonized in the year 1920. 1453 came the fall of Constantinople by the Turks. The Muslims invaded Constantinople, modern-day Istanbul, and just demolished it. The 1400s saw the expansion of Portugal overseas with Henry the Navigator bringing, a great evangelist, bringing the Christian faith to Africa and to other parts of the world. 1450, the invention of the printing press. The first book to ever be printed was the Catholic Bible on the printing press. 1500s, we've heard about this century, the abuses in the church of nepotism, getting your cousins to be bishops and priests and giving them strategic places, making people, little kids cardinals at the age of 7 and 14, and giving bishops like 5 or 10 dioceses. So there was some problems in the church there. For example, Innocent VIII was the pope at that time. He had 2 illegitimate children before he became a priest. Then the year 1492 to 1503 came Alexander VI, and he was considered the worst of the popes. He had 4 illegitimate children while as a bishop, and 1 as a pope, 1 while he was pope. But so he had 5 illegitimate kids after he became a bishop. But he was, the good thing he did was he ordered the public recitation of the Angelus in St. Peter's Square. Who knows what happened there. This is also the time of the writing of The Imitation of Christ by Thomas a Kempis during this, around the 1500s. In Spain at this time came the greatest queen in the history of the church, Queen Isabel of Spain. And she was, again, queen in the year 1470, and she ended, she was able to, first of all, during her reign with her husband Ferdinand, brought, the Catholic faith to Americas, through Columbus, brought peace in Spain, and reformed the church all at the same time. At the same time, she knitted her own socks for her kids and went to daily mass, and just a tremendous Catholic queen. And she ended anarchy in Spain, and she's the one, of course, who established the Spanish Inquisition. And during this time, the reason why the Spanish Inquisition was established was near 1480, there was a massacre of 12,000 Christians in Otranto, Italy. And near 1480, the Muslims invaded this Christian city, killed 12,000 Christians, and sawed the bishop in half. And because of that, this had been promulgated oftentimes by what is called false conversos or false Christians, people who claimed to be Christians who were secretly Jews or Muslims, Queen Isabel established the Spanish Inquisition, and the leader of it was Torquemada. And you hear a lot of bad stuff about the Inquisition, but it was considered the fairest court in Europe at the time, much more fair than many of the courts and Inquisitions in other countries. Here are the statistics from over the course of 23 years, from 1481 to 1504. There were 100,000 people investigated before the Inquisition. 83,000 were acquitted and released. So 83,000 were released. 15,000 had to make an act of faith and were given a penance and released. That brings it to, that's 98,000 people were basically, unharmed. 2,000 were executed over the course of 23 years. Again, we can never justify the killing of this type, but this is important statistics to know. When people will say, the Spanish Inquisition killed hundreds of thousands of people, again, it was considered the fairest court in Europe, and people would much rather be tried before the Inquisition than other courts. So 2,000 out of 100,000 were executed over the course of 23 years. An Inquisition was eventually set up in Mexico, and in the course of 277 years, only 41 people were executed in 277 years. In Peru, where an Inquisition was set up, in the course of 200 years, 59 people were executed in the course of 200 years. Whereas if you compare that to England and the Protestant and the witch burnings that took place, there were as many as 10,000, 20,000 witches who were just basically the old ladies who might have had a couple of warts or something like that. And people said, oh, she's a witch. This lady is a witch. And so they were taken, and whereas there were no witch burnings in Spain, because these old ladies would be taken before the Inquisition and say, hey, you're not a witch, go home and go back to making stew or whatever you're making. Okay, then the year 1490 came, and that was the year that the 770 years of fighting against the Muslims came to an end. And see, Columbus had gone to Isabel and said, will you finance my journey over to, basically, he wanted to go, all the way to Asia, Japan, and China the other way. He thought he could just sail around the other end of the world and hit Asia, Japan, and China. Luckily, he discovered the Bahamas, the Canary Islands, and Cuba on the way. Otherwise, he never would have made it all the way around. Luckily, those places happened to be there. In fact, that the Canary Islands, Bishop O'Malley says, the Canary Islands are very similar to the Virgin Islands in that in the Canary Islands there are no canaries. Okay. then he, 1492, the expulsion of, this was something that doesn't look good on Isabel's record. 1492, she expelled all the Jews from Spain. 160,000 Jews were asked to leave, and basically they had to leave the country. And that's one reason why it's hard to say whether Isabel will ever be canonized. Many people think she should be canonized, but this is certainly holding up the cause. Even though she didn't treat them badly, she just expelled them from the country, which, isn't too good, I guess. As far as slavery, one of the problems was, Columbus and these people, had some slaves, but Isabel freed them. When these slaves were sent back, by Columbus as a gift, Isabel, she immediately freed them and told, Columbus not to, take slaves. The year 1519 came a great emperor, Charles V, who was the Holy Roman Emperor, the grandson of Isabel and Ferdinand, and he was one of the greatest, probably the greatest, Holy Roman Emperor in the history of the Church. He was the one who tried to help reform the Church and also tried to deal with the havoc that Luther was causing. Martin Luther from Germany began his preaching, and especially about indulgences, the sale of indulgences, and he had a good point about that. But he also did not like Rome being over Germany. The papacy was in Rome, and he didn't like any kind of political power that Rome had. And as thousands and tens of thousands of people left the Catholic faith to follow Luther and eventually Calvin and Zwingli, at the same time, Cortez was, going into Mexico City, year 1519. And remember, Cortez brought the Christian faith. When he got there, he found that the Aztecs were doing 50,000 human sacrifices a year of babies and human, and adults, 50,000 a year. Of course, that was stopped. And when, a neat story, when Cortez got there, all his men got on Mexico, they lit their ships afire. They burned their boats because they said, we're not going to leave. So they had to win. And it's a good example, this idea of you have to burn your boats and just go ahead and go. The year 1520, this is when, it's only a year after Luther began some of his writings, he was already calling the Pope the Antichrist by the year 1520. and you've heard about the peasant uprising in the year 1525 that even surprised Luther. Luther did not necessarily like that. He was surprised that all these people, these groundswell people, were beginning to follow him. And in Switzerland, people were following Zwingli, who was very radical. He denounced any kind of images, any kind of statues or icons. He denied the real presence. Calvin was from France. We heard about that other night, about predestination, how he promoted that. At the same time that people were leaving the Catholic faith, Ignatius of Loyola, the year 1528, was trying to establish his order, later known as the Jesuit. It's interesting that at that same time, 1528, Calvin and Ignatius of Loyola were studying at the same time at the University of Paris. They might pass each other in the halls, most likely. Yeah, in the year 1540, the Jesuits were established. And as thousands of tens of millions of people were leaving the Catholic faith in Europe, year 1531, the Blessed Mother appeared to Juan Diego, and within 10 years, 10 million Indians were baptized and brought into the Catholic faith. You see how Our Lady worked, appearing at the same time that a great portion of Europe was leaving the faith, millions of people were entering the faith. At the year 1545 to 1563 came the Council of Trent, and this is called the Catholic Reformation. See, they don't call it, like Dr. Carroll, who I had for history, never called the Protestant Reformation a reformation because it didn't reform the church. It basically set up other churches. He called it the Protestant Revolt, whereas this, what took place in the 1550s, was the Catholic Reformation, spearheaded by the Council of Trent. Henry VIII was over in England at this time, and Thomas More is one of his advisors. You know that story about John Fisher and Thomas More remained loyal to the Pope. Both of them were executed by Cromwell and by Henry VIII in the year 1535. And then Cromwell took the English monasteries. And I've seen some of these incredibly beautiful monasteries and cathedrals that were taken by Henry VIII and Cromwell, and many of the monks were killed. The year 1553, Mary Tudor married Philip II. During the Council of Trent, 1566, the Pope at this time, one of the greatest popes in history, Pope Pius V, implemented the Council of Trent. Council of Trent was from 1545 to 1563. It was met on three different occasions because of wars and things. They had to stop it and start it and stop it and start it. One of the greatest implementers of the council also was St. Charles Borromeo, 1562 to 1584, the Bishop of Milan. Did seminary training, seminary reform. Another great reformer was Peter Canisius from Germany and St. Robert Bellarmine. The year 1556 to 1598 came another great Catholic king, Philip II, and there was a real tension between William Cecil of England, who basically ran England, even though Queen Elizabeth was the queen. She was a puppet of William Cecil, who was a bitterly anti-Catholic, versus Philip II of Spain, who was a tremendous Catholic king. A persecution broke out in England in 1570. In the 1570s, you've heard of St. Margaret Cicero, who was pressed to death between two huge stones of Catholic women. You've heard of the Battle of Lepanto. This is when this took place, 1571, between, again, all this time the Turks are still fighting, Turks and Muslims are the same, that you use his names interchangeably, but the Christians were still fighting the Turks. Battle of Lepanto, October 7th, 1571, a great Christian victory over the Turks, military and naval battle, where by the praying of the rosary, the Christians were able to defeat the Turks. Because Pius V asked all of Christendom to pray the rosary for a great victory, and the Turks were just destroying the Christian forces. All of a sudden the wind changed, gave the Christians a military advantage, and they won that battle. Back over in England, you had the situation over in Scotland of Mary Queen of Scots being the rightful heir. She was imprisoned for about 18 years and then executed. Philip II sent the Spanish Armada in 1586 to try to overthrow the English government and William Cecil. and that was a disaster. Only about one fourth of the ships, eventually got back to Spain. And even so, when both the second falls, it's devastated. Ships coming back, he sang the Te Deum, which is a hymn of praise to God. This time period in the church also saw the great missionary work of St. Francis Xavier in the 1560s, and the other Jesuits going to India and Japan, and this, of course, kept up. For example, Japan had the faith brought to them in the 1640s, and then all the missionaries were eventually either killed or put out, and they had no priest there for 200 years. And when Japan opened up 200 years later, they still had the Catholic faith among the people. 20,000 Christians had baptized and prayed the rosary. They had no mass, they had no other sacraments, but for 200 years they kept the Catholic faith. This was also the time period of Matteo Ricci over in China, taking the faith to China in the year 1610. The year 1618 to 1648 was the 30 Years' War between Germany, France, and Spain. And Cardinal Richelieu, who was supposed to be a cardinal of the Catholic faith, was basically working, for France, and that helped Spain lose that war, that 30 Years' War, divided up, European countries, and it basically said, whichever that countries became known as Catholic countries or Protestant countries, beginning in the year 1648. Then in the 1660s came Louis XIV of France, the famous king who built the Palace of Versailles. At this time also Jansenism was spreading in France. Jansenism was a form of Calvinism, and of course this was condemned by the church. In the year 1683, an incredible battle took place when the Turks invaded Vienna, and John Sobieski from Poland came with 60,000 soldiers. And he had to battle 250,000 Turks, and he won that military battle. They prayed the rosary from Poland to Vienna, and again, a great Marian victory. And last month when I was over in Vienna, we went to the church where this church was built, and Pope John Paul II went to this church in the year 1983 for the 300th anniversary of the liberation of Vienna from the Turks. 1630 came the Galileo controversy. 1660s, Jesus appeared to St. Margaret Mary. 1700 came St. Louis de Montfort. At this time, France was turning atheistic. Voltaire, Rousseau. The Jesuits were suppressed in 1773 because they were so loyal to the Pope, and Jesuits were a tremendous order. This time they had 23,000 members. And many rulers pressured the Pope to suppress them. So the Jesuits were suppressed in 1773. Just a devastating thing, how an order loyal to the Pope was suppressed by the Pope. 1789, Bastille Day, July 14th, and followed by the Reign of Terror. You had people like Bishop Talleyrand, who hated the church, a Catholic bishop who just turned against the church. They overthrew the monarchy. The Reign of Terror, 1792-1793, 2,000 people a day were guillotined by Robespierre, and 2,000 people a day, as compared to 2,000 people in the Inquisition over the course of 23 years, 2,000 people a day were guillotined under the Reign of Terror and Robespierre, and thousands of these were Catholics, priests, and nuns, nuns in their habit being executed and guillotined. Thank God again for the people of the Vendée from Western France, where St. Louis de Montfort had worked. These people again rose up and were able to help with the overthrowing of some of these political revolutionaries. Napoleon came on the scene at this time. 1796, he became a military leader in France and working in Italy. He became the ruler of France at age 30. He bitterly hated the Catholic faith. He called Pope, he basically martyred Pope Paul VI. And in fact, he said, "You will be the last pope." Paul VI, Pius VI. Sorry about that. Well, Apollo 6 wasn't the last one either. he was Pope Pius VI. By this time, you know, Napoleon was overrunning all of Europe. Spain rose up against Napoleon, and the Duke of Wellington, 1810, was able to win some victories against Napoleon. Napoleon then, out of his greed, wanted to conquer Russia. He sends 500,000 soldiers into Russia, year 1812, which is devastated because of the winter, the cold, comes back, just demolished practically, and then rebuilds his whole army, and Austria, Spain, England, Persia all gang up against Napoleon. The people of the Vendée, of France, gang up against Napoleon and defeat him at the Battle of Waterloo. And then he's banished to the island for six years and dies 6 years later. The 1800s saw the industrial age, the age of science. It saw the establishment of socialism, growth of capitalism. It saw a lot of revolutions. It saw the persecution of the church in France. The Blessed Mother appeared at St. Catherine Laboure in 1830. This is really where the Marian Age began. 1830, Immaculate Nettle. 1854, definition of the Immaculate Conception. 1858, Mary appearing to Bernadette at Lourdes. 1864, the Pope issues a Syllabus of Errors. 1870, Vatican I defined papal infallibility. 1888, the Pope issued a document condemning Freemasonry. Then, of course, you have all the social encyclicals. 1903 to 1914 was the reign of Pius X, who was the main opponent of modernism. And 1912 was the sinking of the Titanic. That's just a little bit of an aside. But, but I'm sure it did affect some people. Pius X condemned modernism, and he encouraged frequent Holy Communion. This was also a time of great missionary work in Africa. World War I, 1914 to 1918, Pope Benedict XV pleaded with, the different rulers to obtain peace. None of them listened to him. He prayed to the Blessed Mother on May 5th, 1917. He said, "Mary, we need your help." 8 days later, she appeared at Fatima on May 13th. People don't realize that in powerful prayer, Benedict XV is prayed on May 5th. So this also teaches us it takes 8 days for heaven to hear our prayers. She appears 8 days later, or it takes 8 days to get from heaven down to earth. You don't know. Mary appears at Fatima in 1917, and this was at the same time that World War I was raging. For example, the Battle of the Somme River, I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing it right, 1.25 million young men were killed. It took, for every foot that was gained, 30 men were killed for every foot of ground that was gained. In that one battle, 1.25 million soldiers were killed. It's all trench warfare. And in order to gain a couple feet, they just mowed down millions and millions of young men. So it was a terrible, terrible war, really for no reason. And at this time also, basically, no good came out of World War One. In fact, it enabled communism to grow. And Lenin over in Russia was, bringing about the communist revolution with Rasputin, who was a very mysterious, probably demonically possessed man, possessed by Satan himself. People tried to kill him, and they poisoned him 4 times. He was completely unharmed. They shot him. They stabbed him. People even tied a millstone around his neck, tied his hands up, threw him into a stream, and when they retrieved his body, he had like almost undone all these chains and things. He was most likely possessed by Satan himself. He was also involved in bringing about the communist revolution. 1922, Mussolini in Italy, that situation. Stalin takes over in Russia in 1924. Then, of course, 1929, the Depression in America. Hitler and the Nazis, about 1933, and 1939, the invasion of Poland. At this time, also, the Spanish Civil War was taking place, which was 1931 to 1939, again, Spain defeats communism. And for example, in 1931, the communists burned 106 Catholic churches in that 1 year, trying to destroy Catholicism, the communist infiltration of Spain. And thank God for the tremendous Spaniards who were able to defeat communism in Spain. Under Hitler, of course, came the Pope Pius XII was the Pope, and he was often criticized for not doing as much for the Jews as he could. But when the Pope, whenever he spoke out, you know, it would make the persecution against the Jews and the Christians even worse. So, but the Pope and many people, many Catholics, did hide Jews, and many of them risked their lives and were killed for hiding Jews. And one of the greatest evidences that the Jewish people were protected by the Pope was that the chief rabbi of Rome, named Zwingli, converted to the Catholic faith after the war ended because of his of what Pius XII had done for the Jews. So World War II did away, of course, with the Nazis, but of course not with the communists. Communism continued to spread in China. Mao Zedong, the takeover of China, the bitter persecution of the church, where millions and millions of Catholics were killed. And of course, you have the Korean War, 1950, and Pope John the 23rd became Pope in 1959, and eventually inaugurated Vatican II, which was 1962-1965. And of course, you have the Vietnam War around the early 70s, and then the fall of communism in the in 1990 or whatever the year was in recent history. So, and then Our Lady's promise of the conversion of Russia, the triumph of the Immaculate Heart. So there it is, 2,000 years of church history in about an hour, I guess.